From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Flashpoints. Today on Flashpoints, we turn our attention back to Venezuela and the tightrope Delcy Rodriguez and the leadership of the Bolivarian Revolution are being forced to walk by the Trump regime. Then we look at the tremendous amounts of money being made off of what appears to be insider trading based upon U.S. military moves transmitted by Trump over social media. The new digital landscape takes corruption and war profiteering to a new level. I'm Kevin Pina, and we'll be right back with that and more here on Flashpoints, your daily investigative news magazine. Stay tuned. And welcome back to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. When the United States military bombed Caracas and abducted President Nicolas Maduro earlier this year, the architects of empire in Washington genuinely believed the Bolivarian Revolution would simply collapse overnight. They operated on the arrogant assumption that taking out the leadership would immediately fracture the state, allowing a U.S.-backed transition council to comfortably walk into the Miraflores Palace. They were wrong. Instead of collapse, Washington was met with the absolute constitutional continuity and fierce grassroots resistance now operating under the leadership of Vice President Delcy Rodriguez. Realizing that the revolution survived the initial shock and awe, the State Department and the CIA have now pivoted. The new objective is a ruthless, multifaceted campaign to hobble, isolate, and ultimately control Rodriguez's administration. We're seeing a coordinated squeeze, threats of further military action, the tightening of a blockade, and massive diplomatic extortion designed to force her into power-sharing agreements with the exact same right-wing oligarchs who just cheered on the bombing of their own country. Joining us to discuss the reality on the ground and the resistance to this next phase of the U.S. hybrid war is biologist and grassroots organizer Giselle Perdomo. Giselle, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you for having me.
Giselle, let's start with the mood in the streets. Washington's entire strategy was predicated on the idea that without Maduro, the PSUV and the Venezuelan state would splinter into warring factions. How has the working poor and the grassroots leadership responded to Delcy Rodriguez stepping into the vacuum? And how badly did the U.S. miscalculate the institutional and constitutional strength of the Bolivarian Revolution?
Well, it very much miscalculated, not only those strengths that you alluded to, but also the strength of the people that back the revolution. And so I think that's actually the most important part of it, because sometimes if you live in a country where democracy is just going to elect a president and that's it, you've done your bit and then you go home and go to work, you may think that if you take down a president, then, you know, that's maybe somebody else has to come up with a solution. Socialism in Venezuela, the revolution, not only in Venezuela, in Colombia, and everywhere where it's being constructed, it's being constructed by the people. And so the person in charge, whoever is it, president, vice president, minister, they're one bit of the revolution. They are important. They are an important bit. But they're not all the revolution, and they're certainly not the most important part of the revolution. So the most important part are actually the people at the bottom doing the tough work, the grassroots people, which is what I am a part of. And I think one of the things that you're seeing now is a strengthening of that, because we are seeing, as we have been seeing, but we're seeing it even more so now, we are seeing how the U.S. intends to change what we have for many, many years been constructing. So we are now, for the case of food sovereignty, I have been in several meetings trying to organize nationally to make sure that if the U.S. tries to, for example, change the seed laws or change laws that have to do with the distribution of land that would then affect food sovereignty, they will be met with a very organized and very strong resistance. So that's the mood in the streets. The mood is we continue to want what we have been constructing, which is a socialist state. We continue to want that, and we continue to work towards that. It's not about the president. It's not about the vice president. It's about the people in the grassroots organizations, in the communes, in the streets, trying to create a better world for themselves. And so it's a very, very big miscalculation. It's not about Maduro.
Well, it's interesting because those are the very structures that Chavez empowered and always envisioned as being the strength of the base of the Bolivarian Revolution, correct?
That is correct. And it's empowered in many senses. It's empowered by motivation, empowered by education, and empowered by the actual state being closer to those bases. Well, there was a change also in the electoral system such that there were more electoral places where there were more people, which would seem logical and democratic. But if you think about the social structure of most countries, most people are poor. If you put more voting areas, more voting places in the places where the poor are, you will elect people that are seeking to do good things for the poor. So there was a restructuring of the electoral system, and that's just one bit of the things that gave power to the people. And it's not only Chavez, it's also Maduro. Maduro went along in the strengthening of communes, which gives people a capacity to choose what programs need to be funded within their community to fix whatever problem the community finds necessary to solve, but also giving the community the money to do the changes. So in a way, bypassing mayor's office, in a sense. So the the idea of constructing a socialist state or a socialist revolution is the actual phrase of power to the people. Like, that is exactly what has been done, and it's been years and years of that. And so thinking that taking out the head of state will change any of that is very it comes from a state that thinks that capitalism works everywhere, like as if we were a capitalist state and changing the president is going to do something. Listen, this is a socialist state. It has been, we have been constructing this, which means that a lot of people have been together doing a whole lot of things. We know what we're seeking to do. We want power to the people. We have been constructing that, and we will continue to do that. So what I was saying about food sovereignty, these organizations that we have been meeting, they've got a history of managing to get, for example, food directly from the farmers to low-income communities. And it's been 10 years of doing that sort of work. And if you get the experiences of all of these organizations together and form a national front, that is what the gringos, you know that term? Is that a familiar term over there?
Of course.
Are going to have to fight against. It's not, it's not about a president. It's not about a constitution. It's not about the laws, despite the fact that all of those are important. But what you really are trying to take down is years and years of many people organizing themselves to have a better country. That's very hard to take down.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that's the voice of our guest today, Giselle Perdomo. We're discussing the situation in Venezuela and the strength of the grassroots movement in continuing socialism and the Bolivarian Revolution, despite the U.S. having kidnapped President Nicolas Maduro and Congresswoman and First Lady Celia Flores. Well, the U.S. strategy is currently, the U.S. is currently engaging in what can only be described as geopolitical mafia tactics. They're offering to ease the devastating sanctions, but only if Rodriguez agrees to a forced transition or power sharing agreement with the U.S.-backed opposition. From your vantage point in Caracas, what specific moves is Washington making right now to sabotage her ability to govern? And how is the government navigating this massive extortion campaign?
It's an interesting question. I think, I mean, just the overall madness of the Trump administration is pressure enough.
Like, yeah.
it doesn't really have to
we know that here too.
Be directed at us.
Yeah.
I mean, just to know how absolutely out of their minds these people are, how low their morals are, how far they are willing to either threat or actually act in terms of war. We see what the U.S. has done in Iran. We see what it continues to fund and allow in Gaza. So even if they weren't directed directly at us, they would be pressure enough. Mm-hmm. But apart from that, we've got what happened in January and all of these officials from the U.S. coming over and having a chat, which is, I don't know exactly what conversations are going on there, but one can imagine what those are about. They're about facilitating the income of the, just taking our oil basically, and not only our oil, also all the minerals and any resources that they may seek to want. And this isn't new, but it's very overt now. And the grassroots movements are just aware of the pressure that Delcy is under and the whole government is under. But we continue to hold steadfast to our ideals, and we will continue to defend the revolution in the same way that we have been doing for many, many years, regardless of who is the government of the USA.
And let's go ahead and take a short break here. When we get back, we'll continue our discussion about what's going on in Venezuela with our guest Giselle Perdomo. Stay tuned for that and more here on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Los que mueren por la vida no pueden llamarse muertos. Y a partir de este momento es prohibido llorarlos.
Compañero Hugo Chávez, presente, la revolución bolivariana, presente, let's go.
Yo en Caracas, el proceso va para adelante.
And in Chicago,
el proceso va para adelante.
Yo in the South Bronx,
el proceso va para adelante.
It goes worldwide.
El proceso va para adelante.
I can't front, I'm upset that they took our building. Next thing, the comandante, man, I know they killed him. Something going on, I gotta read the signs. Something telling me that it's about that time. Time to step it up, cause I still smell sulfur. Still smell the money in this capitalist culture. I'm dedicating verses to my boy Jamil. He out there in Venezuela, front line is real. Hunts Point, New York, 2005. That's when I realized the revolution's so alive. We ain't never had a president come around mine. He brought oil for the poor in the wintertime. He showed love to the Bronx, that's called solidarity. We show love back, ain't no politician scaring me. Anti-imperialist, till I go delirious. The work is getting serious, that's why they keep fearing us. Mathematics, Hugo Chavez was the baddest. I gotta work like Chavez. Do the mathematics, Hugo Chavez was the baddest. I gotta work like Chavez.
Yo, in Caracas, el proceso va pa'lante.
And in Chicago,
el proceso va pa'lante.
Yo, in the South Bronx,
el proceso va pa'lante.
It goes worldwide.
Forward, this movement ain't defeated. La lucha sigue. Dentro de todo esa rebeldía existe. La CIA comete crimen. Igual las ideas viven. Aquí el pueblo decide, no lo que los medios dicen. Quieren parar una cultura alternativa. Fíjate desde el Bronx hasta América Latina. Capitalistas van, capitalistas vienen. Buscan tus bienes, quieren hacer lo que quieren. Ahora decimos no, no al imperialismo. Neoliberalismo, los bancos, los ricos. Ni un millonario, Chávez fue solidario. Ni Bush ni Obama llegaron a ayudarnos, no lo olvidamos más que venezolano, esto cruza fronteras, hijo bolivariano, América Unida, como creamos ese frente, solidaridad por todo el continente.
Do the mathematics, Hugo Chavez was the baddest. I gotta work like Chavez. Do the mathematics, Hugo Chavez was the baddest. I gotta work like Chavez.
Yo, en Caracas, el proceso va pa'lante.
And in Chicago,
el proceso va pa'lante.
Yo, in the South Bronx,
el proceso va pa'lante.
It goes worldwide.
And welcome back to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio and my interview with Giselle Perdomo from Caracas, Venezuela. As high-level political chess is played in Washington and New York, You know, the economic terrorism against everyday Venezuelans continues. You work directly with urban farming collectives trying to feed the population. Has there been actual material relief to the blockade since the U.S. shifted its focus to Rodriguez, or are the sanctions still being weaponized even more aggressively to quietly starve the population into turning against her?
I mean, the sanctions remain, and no matter whether they lift them right now, all of the thousands of sanctions, you still have the impact and the consequences of years and years of that. So any change now will have to take several years, if not decades, to actually make a very strong difference. There was an impact on child mortality. There was an impact on child malnutrition. There was an impact on the capacity of the state to maintain its hospitals, its education system. So the consequences we will continue to feel for many years to come. Hopefully, the changes will ease many of the complications, but it's not going to be easy. Regardless of whether they lift all of the sanctions. And there will still have to be many difficult decisions to be made. So many difficult decisions to be made. For example, what are we going to do about the IMF and the World Bank? They have said that they are willing to talk to Venezuela now. Thank you. Thanks to the US. What's our policy towards them now? Mm-hmm. We have seen what they have done, what they have been willing to do. We have seen, for example, during the pandemic, how we weren't allowed access to funds to get vaccinations. And so our history tells us that we can't trust these institutions and these companies that are now coming over and saying, oh, how can we help? How can we help Venezuela? And I think the high level chess that we need to play is to remember who our friends are, who our allies are. And try and work with them, despite the fact that not only is there someone holding a gun to our heads, but it's not any person, any random person. It seems like it's this drugged up mafia guy. And so it's going to be difficult, but we certainly need to remain allies with the people that and the countries that were true allies from the beginning, and not, I believe, start finding these companies that now want to talk to us and these countries that now want to talk to us as, you know, trustworthy. We need to stay strong, stay, keep our ideals and understand who our true friends are.
Well, is there the same sort of battle that there used to be in the press? You know, are part of the press in Venezuela trying to paint Delcy as a pragmatist who's willing to negotiate the revolution, a way to appease the West? And how are grassroots organizations viewing these attempts by the international media to divide the leadership from the base? Is there any fear that the pressure from Washington will force unacceptable concessions, such as accepting the IMF and signing an agreement with them?
I mean, it's a tough pill to swallow, to be honest, to see the things that are happening. But I think this is a mature people. It's a mature revolution. We know what the road is. I mean, the option of getting the right into power would be worse than anything that you could imagine. Recently, there was a show by Maria Corina Machado, the supposed Nobel Peace Prize winner, chanting with a whole lot of people in Madrid, chanting, out with the monkey, out with the monkey. So the monkey is, of course, Delcy Rodriguez. This doesn't surprise me because I have lived through what the right here in Venezuela has done. I was 8.5 months pregnant when they were trying to block the streets and, you know, putting, I don't know, anything that they found in their homes to block the streets. And I found it hard to go to see my doctor, my obstetrician, 8.5 months pregnant. So I know what these people do. They are my neighbors. They are people that I have heard say things like chavistas need to be killed twice a week. So I have no doubt that we need to hold on to power, not only because of the good things that we are doing, but also because of the bad things that the right and the extreme right represent for Venezuela. So they represent violence, they represent racism, they represent a whole lot of concessions to the US in terms of our resources. They represent a lack of sovereignty. So they are not an option in any way. So what we need to do is to find a way to keep the revolution going under these current circumstances, which aren't easy. But, you know, Delcy has her work to do, and she, I trust, will find a way to do it. And also grassroots organizations know that we are in a particularly threatening situation at the moment, and that we need to just band together and make sure that we understand who is with us and who is against us, and try and, yeah, just go with the, try and find a solution under these very difficult circumstances.
Well, it also seems that one of the primary goals of U.S. regime change is always to fracture the military. But so far, the Venezuelan armed forces and the civilian militias have remained fundamentally loyal to the Constitution, to your Constitution, in the face of this renewed attempt to topple or control the current administration. How critical is the civilian-military alliance right now in preventing the complete takeover by U.S. proxy forces?
Yeah, well, you see, again, I feel like what's most important is actually the people. Mm. For example, when Chavez was taken out of power in 2002, some of the military was in on it. Mm-hmm. But it was the strong will of the people, the unwillingness to accept anyone but Chavez, that made such conditions that they had no other option but to bring him back. Right. And so that's where my hope lies. That's where my strength lies. Not in whether or not there are some people in the military that could want Delcy out, or, I mean, I can't imagine that in the militias anything would like that would happen, because these are forces that came to get their training because they were so, they understood so well how important it was for the people to defend the revolution, right? So I don't have any particularly strong feelings that the militia could be part of a coup in any sense. Whether or not there are people in the military that would be willing to be treasonous, maybe, I don't know. But that's not where the actual problem would be. Like, maybe they can buy some military people, as they have done in many parts of the world, and who cares? That's not my concern. My concern is the people. We won't stand for it. We won't stand for Maria Corina Machado. And I think that's a calculation that maybe the U.S. has. Like, they could have tried a coup. They've tried it before here in Venezuela. They could have tried that. But I guess they realized that stability is the most important, and that the only way that there will be political stability and social stability is if the revolution continues to be in power. If they did that calculation, I think that they are right.
That attempted coup against Chavez that was unsuccessful, we have to add, because ultimately the military did not back it. And that's interesting, because the Venezuelan military has sort of slowly gotten rid of those elements that were trained in the U.S. The Venezuelan military high command is no longer, you know, a product of the U.S. military and Pentagon bilateral relationships and treaties, is it?
I believe it isn't, no. And I think because Chavez was such an icon. I was recently remembering when Chavez died, and his funeral, Ahmadinejad from Iran came, the president, and I remember him crying on the casket. And it was such a strong moment for me, and I think for everyone. I mean, we all went to walk the casket from where it was and then to the final place. And this was like this gigantic mass mobilization of people that were so touched by Chavez in many ways. And he was a military man, and he was able not only to touch the hearts of the people of Venezuela, but of the military as well. And I think that probably is still there in many people, and it's very important. If Chavez was able to find such a strong link, even to people outside of Venezuela, such that his death would bring them to tears, like this grown man from Iran crying, the president of Iran crying on the casket. When have you ever seen such a thing for any other president elsewhere? Like, do you imagine anyone crying over Trump's casket? And you know, any leader of the world. But Chavez was a symbol. He was honest. He was motivating, and he brought the people of Venezuela to believe in this wonderful dream that we actually constructed over the years. And I think that goes for Venezuelans in general, and it goes for Venezuelans in the military. And well, it had certainly over the years shown to be the case that there are many loyal people in the military. How many millions of dollars did the U.S. offer for Maduro's head? And they didn't get it. They had to come over here and get themselves. The U.S. had to come with 150 planes to actually come and get Maduro, because no matter how much money they offered, the Venezuelans did not give him up. So I think that tells you about the level of honesty and conviction that can be found in the military.
No, are you folks there in Caracas and in Venezuela in general hearing about the kangaroo court, the trial that's going on in New York? And what are people's responses? I know that people clearly see this as a kidnapping of their sovereign leader. I know that there are still movements, very strong movements, to return the president. But what are you hearing there is going on in New York, and what is the impact that it's having there on people?
Well, personally, I haven't been listening. I haven't been reading up much on that. I haven't gotten those news reports. As far as I understand, it's taking a long time, and it's being a kangaroo court, as you state. And so it's outside my control. I can't do much more than write him letters, which I encourage people to do, because he's a political prisoner inside the United States. Mm-hmm. There are campaigns to write both him and Celia letters to tell them that they haven't been forgotten, and that everyone feels that this is just an injustice that will be corrected over time. But that's as far as I can go. Whereas here in Venezuela, I know that I can continue to strengthen the revolution, and that is what we need. Hopefully in the US, you guys will figure your stuff out, and you really need to do that. And you really need to come out and protest against what the United States is doing in Venezuela and in Iran and in Gaza and everywhere else. Because it affects you guys as well, but it's a fight that should be international. What we're trying to construct is a world in which the all countries respect each other, and where the little guy is not trampled on. And I don't know. I mean, what we need to do here in Venezuela is what I feel I am doing, which is strengthening national movements, grassroots movements, to make sure that there is a united and strong front against any of the interests of the United States. What, in particular, in my case, what we may be finding is that they come to change laws that have been instrumental in giving Venezuela food sovereignty. So we're trying to construct an agriculture that is based on local seeds, that is based on non-industrial farming. And what we know that the United States exports is actually GMO products and massive corporate agriculture, which is not something that we want and which is not something that will feed Venezuelans. So I'm doing what I know I need to be doing, which is to make sure that there's a united and strong front against what the U.S. Interests are. And they are definitely the opposite of Venezuelan interests. I can't do much about the kangaroo court. I wish I could, but I just need to focus on what I can do here for real problems that we may be coming in front with.
Well, very logical, honest, and heartfelt approach to it, I believe, and very beautiful words, Giselle Perdomo. Thank you for joining us today and sharing your views here on Flashpoints. Very, very appreciative, and as I'm sure our audience is. Thanks, as always, Giselle.
Thank you for doing what you do. It's very important as well that if you guys can do something over there, that you do it, that if you can maybe write Maduro a letter. You can also join, I would encourage you to join the Venezuela Solidarity Network. You can find them in Instagram, and probably they've got a website. They do wonderful webinars where you get information about what's going on in Venezuela. You can ask people things. You can find ways to do work over in the U.S. or to come over here with a delegation. Find a way to help. Don't stay home and feel like, you know, the world has gone to pieces. There are things that we can do. There is work that you can do over there, and it's needed. So let's just all of us try and get through this.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Giselle. Giselle Perdomo.
My pleasure. Really, thank you for doing what you do.
No, of course. Giselle Perdomo coming to us from Caracas, Venezuela. We'll be back to you soon.
To liberate our world.
Take to the streets and protest in the USA.
In the USA.
Take to the streets and protest in the UK.
In the UK.
Take to the streets and protest in the USA.
In the US.
Take to the streets and protest in the UK.
In the UK.
Pay no attention to Falklands and their polls. Listen to the voices that are deep in our souls.
And welcome back to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We often talk on this program about the horrific human cost of the U.S. war machine, from the bombing of Iran to the strangulation of Venezuela. But there's another deeply cynical side to U.S. aggression. The sheer amount of money being made off the bloodshed by defense contractors and now political insiders before the bombs even drop. Late last month, on March 23rd, just 15 minutes before a major presidential social media post, never thought I'd ever be saying that, regarding the conflict in Iran, over $760 million in oil futures was traded. This wasn't a lucky guess. Financial experts and legal analysts are now pointing to a highly suspicious recurring pattern. Massive, perfectly timed market bets being placed right before the White House makes policy announcements on everything from tariffs to military escalations. While the working class deals with inflation and the threat of a global war, Washington insiders are treating geopolitical chaos like their own private casino. Joining us to follow the money and expose this unprecedented level of executive branch grift is Jeff Hauser. He's the founder and executive director of the Revolving Door Project, an organization dedicated to tracking executive branch corruption, corporate capture, and the systematic failure of our regulatory agencies. Jeff, welcome to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
It's great to be here.
Well, let's talk about this $760 million coincidence. You know, let's start with the hard numbers. We're looking at over $750 million in oil futures traded just 15 minutes before the president tweeted about Iran policy on March 23rd. Walk us through the mechanics of a trade like this. How impossible is it to execute a market move of this magnitude with this level of precision unless you're sitting on non-public insider information directly from the administration?
It's massively complicated. I mean, these markets are liquid. I mean, I don't mean to make a pun about oil. They're liquid, but there still is finite amounts that are being traded at any given moment. If you're assembling this sort of bet at this size, you're going to do so with not just a generalized sense about the nature of the market or global events. You got to do so with great confidence. Otherwise, this bet can really backfire on you. There's a lot of leverage at play here, and that leverage means potential for tremendous upside, but it also means significant downside risk, a risk that, you know, most institutions would not take without some basis for great confidence.
So I think you're making the case here that you'd have to have specific information before you'd make that kind of a play.
I mean, it would be wildly reckless. Obviously, I cannot say that in the history of American capitalism, wildly reckless behavior is entirely impossible, and we can exclude that possibility. I can't say that with a metaphysical certitude, but given the trajectory of this administration, given the suspicious trades made in betting markets, prediction markets about the Maduro capture and the previous killing of the Ayatollah, I think, you know, one would have to be pretty credulous to accept that this is just a well-timed, lucky bet. I think it's probably more, but obviously what we'd like to have happen right now is a serious independent investigation by well-resourced prosecutors and federal regulators without any fear that if they found somebody guilty, that they would get fired. But I mean, that is not something that is in the offing, I believe.
Well, it sounds, based upon what you just said, that there's enough of a smoking gun to justify that kind of investigation. How would such an investigation go forward, and what exactly might it look for?
So, I mean, this is relatively uncharted territory in that the commodities markets are, the insider trading laws as applied to the commodities markets is a relatively new innovation. I don't know why it's new, because it should have existed for a long time. But the pattern actually of America creating laws against insider trading is pretty haphazard. And it's never been as strong statutory prohibition as you would expect. The term insider trading, conventionally understood, encompasses a broad array of activities. Unfortunately, both due to defects in the text of the statutes and courts made up of corporate defense attorneys turned judges, it's been a little bit of a Swiss cheese kind of style of protection. So there have not been that many big commodities market insider trading investigations. They're very complicated. And most of the people who would do a significant insider trade that could really move commodity markets are also going to be extremely well represented and may have covered their tracks well. So there's not a great, there's not as much of a pathway to how this would go as there is on securities. Just to remind your listeners, commodities are things like oil or wheat, and securities are things like stock in Google or General Motors. And the Securities and Exchange Commission has long investigated securities insider trading, and they don't have a perfect track record, but there's at least like a significant track record. Commodities are under the rubric, the scrutiny of the CFTC, which is a smaller agency with less prestige, far fewer regulators even before Trump's administration. And so they don't have that much of a track record of doing the types of investigations that are warranted here. So they have said that they are going to look into this due to pressure from senators.
Well, and that pressure is largely coming because of the sort of cascading quality of mounting evidence, because it's not just about war, right? I mean, the corporate media usually treats these incidents as isolated ethical lapses, but we're seeing it happen around defense stock surges, tariff announcements, and now the escalation of massive war in the Middle East. You'd mentioned earlier also this question of the revolving door, which of course your project is dedicated to pointing out to the American public, how this has led to moral lapses and lack of active and thorough investigations in the past, because let's face it, that revolving door means that many of the same people who might prosecute such a case have cozy relationships with corporate America, but also with previous administrations.
Absolutely. So there are two types of revolutions. There is revolving into the government, not because you've decided your new career is going to be public service, but you want to have a short stint in government in order to make more money when you return out to the public, to the private sector. Right. And then there's the revolution of people who have been working in government out. So revolving into the government from a regulated part of the private sector. We're not talking about like, I'm a doctor in private practice and now I'm at the Veterans Affairs. That's like totally fine and normal. I'm talking about like trying to make policy. And so when people revolve into the government with an eye toward leaving, they may want to be competent in government. Not everyone in that scenario is corrupt, but they definitely don't want to make waves, push the envelope, and lose cases. And so there is a book by the journalist Jesse Eisinger, The Chicken, let's say, Poop Club, which is about how prosecutors often are fear losing, and you're more likely to lose when corporations and super rich people are on the other side of an investigation. And so people will bring the obvious cases to bear, and they might do their best on those, but they don't take risks of losing, which is what's going to be necessary to go after the powerful or politically connected people who are most likely committing insider trading, especially insider trading of insider information to the Trump administration. So that's one concern, people being reluctant to have conflict, worried about their perception on the outside because they want to go into the private sector and make a lot more money. Then you also have the concern that people representing the people who may have done shady activities here, they know the ins and outs of government. So they know exactly what the government will understand and what they won't understand. What are the blind spots? So it's like if you hire somebody, during NBA playoffs, if you had somebody on your staff who a few weeks ago was coaching the other team, right, they would give you a lot of insight into those players and the playbook, and that would be a huge advantage to you. Well, that goes especially here. You can say, look, they don't have the resources to look into this area, so if your activities are in that space, you're going to be safe. They can give a scouting report that is deeply valuable, and that's one of the things that we're very concerned about. It's the playbook stealing by people who've been in public, and then they privatize their knowledge of how the government works, and they sell it on the open market to the highest bidder.
Well, let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of our guest, Jeff Hauser. He's a founder and executive director of the Revolving Door Project. We're talking about insider trading, possible prosecution for this in the future. I mean, it's also true, Jeff, that once there appeared to be at least a stronger agreed line of demarcation, and it seems as if that's been eroded. I mean, we see tremendous overlapping between the billionaire class, finances, potential economic enrichment, and this current Trump administration at various levels, not only him personally, but also his family as well. It seems almost as if that line that was once respected of a separation, you know, there was this sort of idea that there was this moral line of demarcation, and you kept what was public and in the public interest separate from that which was personal interest. And now we're seeing that there's almost no line with this administration.
Absolutely. I mean, it is rotten to its core. The first Trump administration was quite arguably the most corrupt administration in American history. And this one makes that first administration look like Jimmy Carter by comparison in terms of its approach to ethics. This is several orders of magnitude worse. It is more open. There are pardons for basically anyone who's ever committed a politically adjacent crime, even sometimes from Democrats. They're just trying to send a signal that certain types of vice are not actually problematic. They are trying to lower our standards. And any sort of effective ethics and political corruption scheme, any effort to regulate our financial markets, there has to be an interworking between the laws, the enforcement practices, and the norms and ethos of the market participants. Right. These things can all work together for the better, or they can work together for the worse. And right now, I think everything is working together for the worse. We have a decline in standards because you're never going to be able to police everything. You want to create a risk in the minds of people that if they break the law, that they're going to be uncovered. But you also want it to be so clear that you're probably going to get caught, or there's a good chance that people start telling themselves, hey, I actually want to do the right thing. I actually look down on people who take risks. And we've had that. I mean, that was the post-World War II Wall Street was not like my favorite institution in the history of America, but it was a pretty boring place. People rather work at manufacturing businesses, commercial product businesses in this country when they left the place, like say Harvard Business School, than go to Wall Street. Wall Street was a backwater. It was boring. And then as they started pushing the envelopes more and more in the 60s and especially in the 70s, that flipped. And so by the 80s, you had greed is good as an ethos that was captured in a movie, but definitely reflected reality. And that ethos, once people start thinking greed is good, it's really hard to be the billionaire police force. And I'm not saying it's impossible, and we really strongly advocate for the idea that we're gonna need people to go after these billionaire scofflaws. We definitely believe that. But it's also the case that there's a culture that is rotten among the rich people in this country. And, you know, there are all these ways in which, you know, Republicans and right wingers have, you know, make comments about the cultures of other people. But honestly, the most broken culture in this country is that of the billionaires and the oligarch class. They do not believe in conventional morality of any kind, be it a, you know, traditional religion, or they just don't have morality other than we want to get rich. And that's a real problem. And I think punishing people for breaking the law will help create, hopefully, a feedback system that can lead to revulsion at those norms. We're probably always going to have some degree of rich people, hopefully fewer who will be none as rich as our richest people right now. But there's unlikely to be perfect equality in this country. But we need the people with more money and more power to be less corrupt. And right now the trends are bad, and they start at the top of Trump and his family, and it extends especially to Silicon Valley. No offense to the people who live in that area, and many of whom are normal, hardworking people. But the plutocrats of Silicon Valley are sending a really bad message, and greed is omnipresent among the oligarch class.
Well, it's interesting. You referenced the 1987 film Wall Street, which was produced and directed by a good friend of this show, Oliver Stone. Gordon Gekko was the character. You know, greed is good, and I think that you're right that the level to which today's billionaire class and soon to be trillionaire class are willing to risk breaking the law, and the risk versus reward system has broken down as it once traditionally worked. I mean, where does that leave us? I'm often worrying about a sociopathic dog eat dog society run by the billionaire class. It seems like we can never go back to those days when there were those staunch allies of the law who fought against robber barons, and we look what had to be done to rectify that situation and change the economy back to something that allowed for what we once called the American dream. I mean, we can never go back, right?
I mean, I would not say never, and that's like the hope. I think, you know, you accomplish returning to not only legal but social accountability brick by brick. And I think the goal,
like,
actually—
Like we lost shift... it. We lost it brick by brick. We got to earn it back brick by brick.
Well, yeah, and I guess actually shifting metaphors, in some extent, we need an avalanche. Like, an avalanche doesn't start with a massive amount of snow at the top of the hill going down. It starts small and it builds on itself. And so I think the more focus our society has on the depravities of our oligarch class, the more there is this discussion, then there'll be more pop culture about it. There'll be more TikToks about it, et cetera. All sorts of conversations will be had. If there are big, high-profile trials, honestly, even if the trials don't lead to conviction or a conviction that stays because the system is still corrupted, our courts are captured, John Roberts' Supreme Court is not to be trusted, et cetera, and they've really made white-collar crime a lot easier to commit or get away with, the Roberts Court. Even if that's the case, I think public education, widespread revulsion, it can go a long way. I mean, part of the radicalization stories that people like Mark Andreessen and Elon Musk have told involves their children going to university and becoming aghast at them. And obviously they blame Marxist universities. Right. I would say they should look in the mirror when they're trying to assess blame. But I do think that they are thin-skinned and responsive to society. So I think that if there is more of a law enforcement approach combined with social revulsion, I think you can reverse course, but you don't reverse the Titanic that quickly. You don't reverse a mountain quickly. So I'm not saying we're going to fix this in the next few years, but I think important steps can be taken. And then the final thing I would mention is that it's ironic that part of why tough on crime generally is a mistaken ideology is it presupposes that there is careful cost-benefit analysis that's being undertaken by people, especially people who are disadvantaged and living in under bleak circumstances. But there is a group in this country of people who are trained to think exclusively in cost-benefit terms, and those are our oligarchs. That is what our shareholder model of corporate capitalism and our business schools and the like are teaching people. So the people who would be most responsive to a greater risk of incarceration are the richest business people. And that's why if we're going to be tough on law and order, we should start at the very top of the social pyramid. I don't think we have to go that far down to make a massive improvement in this country. So that's what we believe in at Revolving Door Project, is that we need to go after the corporate oligarchs, because those are the people whose crimes have the greatest impact on us. It may even, you know, at this moment be encouraging the president to pursue this insane war.
Well, and Jeff, it really is disturbing when the machinery of U.S. foreign policy is being monetized by insiders, because that's really betting on death, right? That's really betting on destruction. And it's even betting on the possibility of more U.S. troops coming home in body bags.
Yeah. I mean, like, these prediction markets are horrifying. I mean, a deputy campaign manager for Vice President Harris, Stephanie Cutter, just went to work for Kalshi. And I don't know how people like that can look themselves in the mirror. My colleague Henry Burke wrote a piece for the American Prospect about Stephanie Cutter and going to Kalshi.
Tell our listeners what Kalshi
really
is.
Gross.
Remind our listeners what Kalshi is.
So Kalshi is one of the two big new prediction market firms. There's Kalshi and there's Polymarket. And they have their idiosyncrasies, but essentially they are, when people say there are prediction markets now, that's what they mean. And combined with the somewhat new, somewhat more old fashioned, but still highly addictive and problematic, like FanDuel, DraftKings kind of
sports betting,
gambling sites, part of just the incredible transition of our society into like a gambling machine. Like, you know, gambling addiction is a massive problem in this country.
Well, I wish we had a, I got to say that it does not portend a very bright future at the moment, but I hope that you're correct, that at some point the right piece will fall, and that that will lead to a cascading effect that might mitigate a lot of what's going on. But I still can't help but feel that at its essence, this is capitalism. This is, it is sociopathic. It does not really care about people. All it cares about is enriching itself and money. And that what we're seeing happen now is just merely a reflection of what are the internal values of our economic system and the way that we do commerce.
Well, I mean, obviously there's been an increase in self-described socialists in this country. And so I imagine quite a bit of that is due to revulsion at how our capitalist system is working. I think the basic idea for people who are outraged is that it is hard to turn things around, but change has happened. Things have looked bleak in the past. And we all just need to do our role, be it in talking within our community, sharing information online, however it is that one communicates and participates in our political society. We just got to like do our bit piece by piece to make people more aware of how gross this all is. And that doesn't presuppose that any one specific reform or revolution will occur. But I think we just need to increase awareness of how our new emperors have no clothes. These are not skillful people who bring real value to society. They are flim-flam specialists. They are con men and con women. And we need to take these people down socially, and we need to take them down legally when that's applicable. And we do it first slowly and then hopefully faster and faster over time. So yes, it definitely seems inherent to the system, and the system is definitely going to a somewhat logical conclusion from its origins, but it has turned around in the past, and it's our job to hasten the turnaround in the future.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Again, that is the voice of our guest, Jeff Hauser. He's the founder and executive director of the Revolving Door Project, an organization dedicated to tracking executive branch corruption, corporate capture, and the systematic failure of our regulatory agencies. Jeff, thanks so much for being our guest today here on Flashpoints.
It was great to chat with you.